Min campus alihor, miai Karsten Schwine. Welcome al program iħor fi sensi la min campus al iħor mi għaj Karsten Xwire diġa wasanna flasħar wieħed min din sensi la ikalla rriti konna uħrajn anki l-qoddim għalix min rispons taqom jider illi sensi la tintoġob jider li rrakkonti l-aneddoti l-istejjer u anki l-mużika illi l-mistednin, illi huma professjonisti, akkademiċi, riċerkaturi, nies li jaħdmu ħafna drabi f'edukazzjoni u li jew fil-politika kulturali, illi b'xi mod jirrifletti l-isfond tiegħi stess, qegħdin jintoġbu din it-tlagħtu anke inkluż l-istudenti illi b'xi mod jistgħu jirrelataw mal-idea ta' rakkont ta' career pass u bej wens, bej konsolazzjoni, bej ispirazzjoni, bej motivazzjoni nisimgħu u nimmaġinaw. Moħna kif dawn in-nies matul ġiri għexiera ta' snin ma kienx faċli lihom u kellhom jaraw dejjem kif jaddattaw u dejjem jivvitaw xi jagħmlu biex iħossu li dan ix-xogħol li qed jagħmlu ifisser xi ħaġa għalihom u għall-komunità tagħhom. Il-persuna li ħa nitkellem magħha llum qed nisimgħu dawn intervista magħha hija Gordi Xindi, hija direttriċi tal-programm tal-Qorti tal-Fondi ta' Chamber Music America u hija tmexxi l-seba' programmi magħrufa bħala flagship projects li jagħtu il fuq minn miljun dollaru fondi lill-ensembles żgħar fid-dinja mużikali. Hija kontributriċi għall-Retool li huwa akronim tajjeb għal Racial Equity in the Panel Process li hija riżorsa illi tipprova telħaq l-ekwità razzjali fis-sistema ta' kif qed tiġi revista s-sistema tal-fondi u s-selezzjoni l-għażla ta' artisti u proġetti ta' arti ġewwa l-Amerika ta' fuq, ġewwa l-Istati Uniti. Kif qed tgħidilna Gardi, il-ħafna snin involuta proprju fuq livell ta' advocacy, kampanji, però anki il-fondi u r-riċerka li jmorru propju biex ħanajdu hekk jippruvaw jiddrittaw għexieren iktar minn 100 sena fil-fatt ta' diżigwaljanzi razzjali ġewwa l-Amerika. Anke fil-kamp kulturali u artistiku, speċjalment dak mużikali. Gardi għandek 28 sena ta' esperjenza fid-dinja performattiva, fil-edukazzjoni tal-arti, fil-kurazzjoni ta' programmi u produzzjoni u fil-żvilupp tal-arti. Kif ukoll fl-aspett tal-medja digitali. Deret f'programmi, dokumentari, ħadet sem f'panels, ħadmet ukoll fuq campuses universitari, ħadet sem f'konferenzi. Bosta pajjiżi mhux ħanaqgħod intihom komm kollha kemm fl-Amerika ta' fuq kif ukoll fl-Ewropa u lil minnhom. Kitbet ħafna pubblikat fil-Theater Research International u fl-Arts and International Affairs żewġ ġurnali li ħarsu lej l-aspetti kulturali, pubblikat ħafna bur digitali u ħarġet anki xogħol ta' fiction. Ta' kitba kreattiva kif ukoll ġabra ta' poeżiji li tħares lejn l-għexieren ta' snin ta' gwerra ċivili illi kissru li Sri Lanka illi kif ħadd tgħidilna għandha rabtiet familjari ma' miegħu. Ħadmet ħafna fuq il-livell anki ta' drittijiet tal-bnedem fuq il-livell globali u anki ħadet numru ta' premijiet għal rights Livelihood Award Bazil Fernando. Gargi ħadbet anki fil-cast ta' film li fil-2008 ġie nominat għall-Oscar u kien rebaħ ukoll premju fi Sundance Film Festival il-film Frozen River. Ejja ngħaddu għal din l-intervista b'saħħitha u mimlija ħafna ma' Gargi Xindi din is-sensiela minn kampus għalieħor. Però infakkarkom ukoll il-mużika li dejjem nisimgħuha fil-din is-sensi hija produta lilna minn ARC Consultancy u sħab internazzjonali u Maltin ukoll tagħhom fil-proġett tal-Unjoni Ewropea illi kien jismu Medinea. matul dal-program, għan nisimaw anki għażla ta' mużika ta' Gorgi Xintej, għalix id-dinja taħra dik ukoll tal-mużika tal-jazz kont speċjali. Allura għan nieħdu gost anki b'din il-mużika żgur. Ejn nisimgħu l-intervista. Welcome back, listeners, to the series Min Campus Alihor, which, as listeners who maybe listened to the program before, knows of, in a way, means campus hopping, connecting campuses from one campus to the other. And sometimes, or many times, guests are really living on campus or practicing academics, working in the sort of the academic realm. However, so I'm interpreting the word campus a bit loosely, to go back maybe to the idea of a place of work, a place of connecting cultures, an environment of exchange, as a professor of mine used to say, sort of places which go beyond those physical spaces. And I think in today's case, as listeners would have heard from the introduction, I think Gorgi Xintej really, really fits that bill. And I think in a way goes beyond it. So first of all, I welcome you, Gorgi, and thank you for being with me on the program.
Thank you so much, Karsten. I'm so excited. I'm looking forward to what our conversation is going to explore and where it's going to go today.
Yes, I guess in this case, like with other guests, to be fair, but in this case in particular, you yourself have traveled and have not only physically, but even culturally in terms of time and space, because you're connecting the American continent, the Asian continent. You've traveled a lot, at least before the pandemic, and hopefully soon, once things start settling down again. For the benefit of our listeners, we're recording this towards the end of summer 2021, so we're in this particular situation. And in preparing for this program, we spoke, you've sent me stuff, we've also prepared some music, which is central to your story, music itself. I think I was thinking of the question along the lines of where does it begin in your time frames, of in your timeline, what were your first steps? But as I hinted at before, before we started this recording, it's a case, to me it seems like a case where there's a bit of prehistory. Your own history predates yourself. There's a period of time where even before you're born into this world, there's been movement, there have been wheels turning. There's history, there's heritage, both on the American side of the world and also maybe even predating that to the Asian side. So I know it's a short time, but a short time for this conversation, and we'll also have some really interesting good music today. But maybe in brief, especially in this first section, you could tell us a little bit, if this makes sense, if what I'm saying makes sense to your life story, and if so, what would you say about sort of the early influences, but even maybe what came before them? Because I know, and as we'll listen with our listeners, there's a lot in terms of history, in terms of legacy, which sort of it comes through you and which you carry on, which you are very aware of and work with, and people who are also in this milieu who you also work with. Let me stop there and let you maybe react to that.
You know, it's the life of an immigrant. You're stitching multiple histories, and there's a beauty to that. There's a beauty to that. You're right in summarizing my work, my journey, my life in such a short, succinct manner, because I always fail.
It's hard.
Yes. But, you know, the journey began with music first. and then everything else. So I was born and brought up in India, which means I left the country when I was 21 years old to seek higher education in the United States. Mm-hmm. And that was my physical journey in so many ways. And I've lived in many, many states here. And of course, mm-hmm. this pandemic has made me move three states within a span of 6 months.
Well, within a short space.
Yeah, displacement. I think this was a displacement. The others were sort of a different kind of journey.
Yes.
But I am the disciple of one of our greatest sitarists, Ustad Abdul Halim Jafar Khan, who is no longer with us. But my childhood is completely colored with music. He was our neighbor. Anytime my mother didn't know what to do with us, she would say, "Go upstairs and play sitar with your guru." It was in so many ways such an innocent and idyllic childhood, you know, which I think our children, specifically in America, we are dealing with this constant specter and reality of gun violence, you know, and I try to understand the contrast in the kind of childhood I had and the kind of childhood these children have here. There's a sort of a loss of innocence in that particular context. So music has always been the conduit, and art has always been the conduit, because when I did come to the United States, I carried my parents' hopes and dreams of studying evolutionary psychology, and changed very quickly to theater history and drama and music and arts, which I think they eventually accepted.
They have to, maybe, just seeing you really, really take it up seriously.
That's right.
In a way, going from the study maybe of human beings through psychology to actually being in it through the arts, through creativity.
100%, Carsten. I mean, you know, theater, the study of theater, Greek theater, the classical theaters of ancient Greece, Rome, also the great Sanskrit classical theater of India. This is all a study in human behavior, ultimately. Mm. So it predates psychology, but what a beautiful linkage of these two subject matters, you know, for me to have sort of traversed.
Yes.
But, you know, life in New York as an artist is no joke. It's no joke at all.
There's quite a bit of psychological pressure there.
Indeed. Most of it is a pressure that comes through living, you know, and this is really what I navigate as an arts administrator. I am just trying to understand under what conditions artists are practicing. Under what conditions do they create these works that really define our culture? And often, you know, it is, it's the threat of eviction. There's no health. You know, the America's sort of health insurance industry and really absurdity is a globally recognized fact.
So I think a few years ago, maybe people in general became even more aware of it because of the whole Obamacare saga, where some people might have even realized that there is no safety net for so many millions of people. And if you're out, you're out.
That is 100% correct. And, you know, this is a great moment to encapsulate how the pandemic has impacted their lives. Mm. I represent, I advocate for what may be considered some of our greatest artists in time. You know, at just 2 months ago, my focus was entirely on our legacy of jazz artists. But in these 2 months, I've now come to represent all music forms in the small ensemble configuration at Chamber Music America. But when the pandemic hit, what became sort of crystal clear to us that our heritage of jazz music was in danger. Mm-hmm. Our artists were immunocompromised. They had a history of bad health because of a history of bad healthcare. They did not have, you know, any stable means of living in the sense that they were all, most of them were living in rented apartments in New York City. They didn't have access to basic groceries. These are some of your finest artists in this music. These are our icons. And to add to that, we had a situation where, of course, you know, live performance was gutted because of, you know, the,
That's right.
The lockdown. And so there was no means to even make money anymore. One more reality that was revealed was that they have no access to the internet. Either they did not have reliable internet. What was revealed that they do not own computers. If they did own computers, they were such old machines that they were not, you know, meeting to this. And lastly, what we realized was, what we found was also that most of our artists, majority of our elder icons, their accessibility to digital media was through their phone. So any intervention that we put out for emergency grants, emergency pandemic money was taking place digitally, right? We were reaching people via email. But there was this entire body of artists who did not hear about it, did not receive the funding. So we went
completely bypassed,
100%. And we went back and said, okay, we have to do this. We have to do this, you know, the old school way.
The old way, yes.
Pick up the phone, find out how these artists are doing. We have to contact their neighbors and fellow artists to knock on their doors.
Physically working through the community. Guy, I was going to say, so on the one hand, I guess maybe there is even still this romantic idea of the sort of bohemian artists, especially in fields like jazz, where you get by. So if you have a precarious life, but that's part of the creativity package. But beyond that, maybe veneer coming back maybe from smoky movies and taking us back maybe to the post-war period, if not even before. But reality is much harsher than that. And one risks losing everything and everyone if the work, for example, that you do is not sustained, is not in place.
Yeah, I want to talk about, and forgive me, Carson, I know you wanted a chronological linearness to this conversation.
It's fun to play with time, more to go back to a classical time, circular thing than a linear thing.
So this is beautiful, because the pieces of music I have shared with you are on that principle. This is so good. Okay, so, you know, I want to make a distinction between industry and artistry. You know, it is the industry that often impoverishes an artist. The artistry is and belongs completely to the artist. It cannot be put in them and it cannot be taken away from them. Even though I represent a body that gives out over $1 million in arts grants, there is nothing we can do for the artist's creativity other than sustain its production. But the creativity belongs entirely to the artist, right? So jazz has a very difficult history with its industry. Its entire history, the music, is almost entirely described in terms of recording technology. So, you know, as with most things in an industry, when certain individuals become redundant for the industry, they're passed over. But what we have, and you know, if you want to really understand how the industry impacts artistry, you want to pay attention to the history of women in jazz. It's really quite a scandal. You know, it's really, really quite a scandal. Not only are they erased from recordings and stages, but often their experience on stage has been one of violence. You know, and this has happened to great women in jazz. When you talk about Melba Liston, she was threatened with violence because she was effectively taking the place of a man on the bandstand. You know, we had a complete cultural reckoning with this Boston Globe expose on Berklee College of Music, mm-hmm. where women students were facing sexual assault in the classroom. So if that is your entry point into the music, if violence is your entry point into the music, how can this be sustained? How can the sustain, you know, how can the creativity of one individual be sustained under such conditions while the others thrive? So the history of jazz is very, very fraught because it became America's greatest cultural commodity at one mm-hmm. point, mm-hmm. you see. And anything that's commoditized is going to come with this kind of baggage. I want you to also think about the world music marketplace. Mm. You know, we are essentially going into countries like Africa, India, yes, yes. you know, these sort of remote cultures in one way, and bringing them out on the Western stage.
Yes.
You know, this is a very commercial transaction. So do we think about artists sustaining their creativity? Do we think about under what conditions are they performing? So in one way, the mm-hmm, pandemic, mm-hmm. I never say the pandemic was, you know, a blessing. It's not a blessing.
Yes, yes.
You know, in the month of April in 2020, the amount of jazz obituaries we were reading was crushing. Mm-hmm. And that's when, you know, I sounded the alarm to our funders in the United mm-hmm, States mm-hmm. saying, you know, we are in the danger of losing America's heritage art form. Mm-hmm. If we don't intervene now and fast, you know. So we want to talk about, we always in our work as administrators, arts administrators, have to make the distinction between the industry that you serve mm-hmm. and the artistry that you serve. Chamber Music America is you know, we're a 43-year-old organization, but we are now in that position where the artist is at the center of this mm-hmm. organization. Mm-hmm. And it is the artist that defines, you know, how this organization best serves their needs. Mm-hmm.
The way you're describing it seems like sort of an evolution, even in your own roles and different practices and responsibilities within the organization. We're somehow, again, speaking of a spiral. The role of the artist always gradually came closer to being at the center. Corgi, I would suggest, since we're sort of a third in, pausing to reflect a little bit on what you spoke to us about, and also turn our focus on the artistic side, and maybe listen to the first of the two tracks we'll be listening together. You want to help me introduce the first track we've chosen, and why?
This brings us back to the beginning, Kirsten.
Yes.
The first track is a performance of my guru, Ustad Abdul Halim Jafar Khan. He's a sitarist, and you know, he's also an innovator. You know, Indian classical music is a heritage tradition, so you know, heritage traditions are usually never spoken of as innovative traditions, but that's not the truth. You know, a lot of these artists are doing excellent things, and he was one such artist who was considered an innovator. He innovated his own style called the Jafar Khani Baj style. And here he performs the rag Sham Kalyan, and you'll hear, and remember, you know, Indian classical music in this way, it's a soloistic tradition, so you will hear him primarily in this.
Very good. Let's listen to it then.
Thank you.
During today's program, we're in Campus Elihor. I'm speaking with Gorgi Shinde. Gorgi, thank you very much for sharing that first piece of music with us. Very inspiring, and I guess we can sort of, myself and the listeners, link that to what you've been telling us about shared heritage, exchange of cultures. But we're not talking about sort of culture from a distance or just appreciatively. You're very much taking us into behind the scenes and into sort of the engine room of how things work, how they are many times loaded against groups of people who are underrepresented, discriminated, and maybe in this middle section we'll have the time to talk a little bit more about that. And also, obviously, a bit of the work you do and all the campaigning and advocacy, what is being done about it? Not just to observe what the situation is, but actually to start sort of shifting the gears towards change. And it's also something which has started now. It's been going on for quite a bit through your work and through your work with many other colleagues. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about that, so that shifts over the recent past up to the present, so that maybe later on towards the end of the program, we'll look a little bit at the future and future possibilities of how this institutional side is relating and maybe reacting, maybe sometimes a bit too late, to what's happening on the ground. And maybe a little bit of the history as well of what's been changing and what's been happening.
So to quickly summarize, you know, how we develop interventions and strategic interventions in the work we do, you know, it's very important to understand that, you know, inequity, you know, this is what we're all dealing with now, you know, inclusion and equity. So there's a deep inequity that characterizes the role of roughly 50 years of institutional support in the arts in America. You know, we have marginalized across identity in an intersectional spectrum of identity, ability, race, you know, gender. And it's rooted in and is a function of the commodification of culture, just what I was talking about. So I want to bring in a quote. This is by a late music historian and critic. His name is Robert Palmer. And in 1980, in the New York Times article, which was an overview of jazz musicians, he observed that jazz's unique encounter with the development of recording technology and distribution makes it the subject to corporate ownership in a way European classical music is not. Right? So in over 40 years since this article, because he wrote it in 1980, nothing has changed. You know, that tells us a lot of what's going on. And now the COVID-19 pandemic, it manifested as an accelerant for our desire to dismantle, you know, first the patriarchy. You know, we were talking about jazz and gender, you know, the women's position in that. a hyper-capitalist ownership, mm-hmm. you know, the digital streaming world that music
yes.
is, exists in today, and a fetishistic visibility, right? Mm. These are token commitments of equity. I want to center the murder of George Floyd here, you know.
Yes,
that was a that was a major catalyst. You know, this is an ongoing historic narrative for Black people in America. Mm. But George Floyd's murder and the, you know, the sort of movement it inspired was very unique because it came into the arts world in a way it hadn't. In a way these violent acts had not in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you had all these organizations making a commitment to Black Lives Matter, Black Lives
yes,
Matter.
Yes.
You know, the what
museums,
is that?
Museums, galleries,
correct.
Opera houses.
Now the problem is we are institutions
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
that collectively invisibilized Black presence. So how do you make a commitment to Black Lives mm-hmm. Matter when mm-hmm. they simply do not exist in your world?
So institutionally, right. structurally,
mm-hmm.
there's sort of that gap being repeated and perpetuated. And suddenly right. there's sort of this commitment which is being done.
Huh?
As you said, there's also an element of tokenism. So because you need to write
that right. way. Right, mm-hmm. right. So, you know, so young Black artists were right to be very cynical and very skeptical of this.
Mm-hmm,
that,
mm-hmm.
Now, you know, I want to say one thing. Our elder Black artists were part of the civil rights movement in America. So for them, this is not this is just a history they've been existing in. They're saying, uh-huh, of course, uh-huh. if you were a Black jazz artist, you were part of the freedom struggle, always.
Mm-hmm.
But our younger artists, you know, they were not ready to simply settle for words anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, what are you going to do for us beyond a token equity commitment? You know? So the problem, Karsten, is that our collective desire and movement towards change in the arts, it is functioning within a half a century old paradigm of arts as a transaction between creator and consumer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, America has a hard time stating that arts should exist for art's sake. We are always stuck we have to always make a pitch for it. Send your
yes,
children
yes.
to band class because it'll uh-huh. help them do better in math.
Yes, yes, yes.
You know, that was, again, not a reality I grew up with. You studied the arts because you had to study the arts.
there was a value in itself for doing that. There was a social dimension to it. There was a cultural and artistic dimension. It made you who you were. I don't want to take too much time and break the flow of your argument, Gargi, but in a very generalizing way, the American approach mm-hmm. to the market has also become global in itself. So in the European Union, as you know, there's a lot of this many of these arguments that need to give value and give validity to learning the arts, somehow
yeah.
relating the arts to sciences or relating yeah. the arts to creativity for business. So this has caught on. And somehow we need to score certain scores and prove there is a certain social and economic benefit. So this has really become global now. It's very hard to reverse or to somehow change. Are you trying to do that, actually trying to sort of modify the way we now constantly think of products and services and have creative industries?
Carson, I love that you just mentioned the social dynamic of music, the social dimension of music, and that is the intervention right there.
Hmm.
That is what we are recognizing, you know, when we bring change. So I want to center not just Black artists in this conversation, because, you know, jazz has a lineage in this music, and a lineage that comes out of an experience of exclusion.
Hmm.
Right. But I also want to bring the experience of indigenous and native artists. You know, institutionally, once again, they have been invisible. And now when we start building bridges with these artists who we have overlooked for half a century, when you overlook an artist community for half a century, there is 50 years of their artistic creativity you have not talked about.
Yes.
You have not included. So now how do you start fixing this, right?
And I suspect because research would be missing. I remember in preparing for the show, you mentioned to me literally on a statistical level. If you're not even mentioning certain groups of people, then in certain cases it might be too late because you've lost that archive.
So this is the learning we had with our native leaders when we went to Colorado to understand what it is that our administrators are not doing correctly. We're doing we've got a lot wrong, but we have a desire to right the wrong, and so we have to start with asking them how to do this. And one tip that has sort of stayed with me throughout is, there was one particular Native leader who said to us that when you, as arts administrators, are reporting your statistics to funders, to board members, even to the artistic community, and you say it as, this year, 30% of women were funded in this funding, or 60% of Black artists received funding. If you funded 0 Native artists, you must state it like that. This year, we funded 0 Native artists. Because for Native artists, often the fight is to even show up as a category on a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
That's how invisible their position is. But we're doing a little better than that. We are reporting better than 0% Native artists. And really, the only way to succeed here, Carson, is to understand the sociological function of art there. And to be honest with you, Europe, countries like Europe, India, and China have a history of that social dimension of art, because our folk arts are so prominent in our day-to-day, lives. It's the same thing with Native artists, their history, their lineage. But at the same time, often when funders suddenly start, funding Black artists or Native artists, there is such an emphasis on tradition that we forget that there are avant-garde artists.
Yes.
There are modern and contemporary artists in these spaces as well that need to be supported. So it's an ongoing process of learning and really tossing out what you've learned, readdressing bad learning in this field as well.
Mm-hmm.
And jazz once again keeps reminding us the tradition of jazz is the avant-garde, and that's why jazz becomes such a beautiful metaphor for change, not just sociological change, the role of jazz musicians in the civil rights movement and in the contemporary civil rights movement since what took place in Minnesota. But also, it is always a metaphor for change, aesthetically as well. The way the music is performed is based on these improvisational, beautiful changes, which you will hear in the second piece when we play
that's
that.
Right, that's right. Gargi, perfect intro to the second track, because we can really sort of think a little bit more, ponder a bit more what you've said while we listen to the second track. What are we going to listen to?
We are listening to the Andrew Cyril Quartet. Andrew Cyril is perhaps jazz's greatest living artist. There are so many. You have no favorites. There are so many. But he's really at a point in his career. What we're about to listen to is a coming together of master artists. You'll also listen to if you get this album, you'll also listen to the great guitarist Bill Frisell, who's a great collaborative partner to Andrew Cyril. But here we are listening to the track called The News off of Andrew's latest release on ECM Records. And here is a master improvising artist on the drums. Thank you.
So Believe is a really, really excellent and current track. Thanks again to Gargi Shinde, who's my guest today on Min Campus Alihor. And in this informal sort of campus hopping, connecting continent stories, institutions, cultural activity. Gargi, you were talking about the history, the recent history, the institutional challenges in jazz and in cultural life in America, but also reflecting on current global situations. I was thinking, so if we look at public funding and public institutions and a lot of work in schools, even on a community level, you were giving us some examples where literally sort of door to door, trying to reach out to members in the community. The program you had with women band leaders, for example, comes to mind, because that was sort of like a very specific thing, reaching out and trying to see the development of these people through and through a lot of their personal and social challenges. But if one had to sort of open up the focus a little bit and look at, let's call it out there, the commercial mechanisms, the way maybe that even informally artists communicate, maybe especially for those of a younger age, is it sort of too much of a set situation? And you seem to have been suggesting sort of that the commercial world, the market, is so set in its ways. So my question, I guess, is sort of, Chamber Music America, yourself, colleagues in the field, doing ever going to sort of to turn the tide? Do you see that happening sometime soon? Would you sort of really call for more efforts, coordinated effort, even by non-public institutions to try to come in?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, it sort of is revealing the absence of a system in the United States. I'm going to give you a sense of scale here. The National Endowment for the Arts, which functions like our federal agency, federal meaning, you know, taking all parts of the country, all parts of the population in account, its annual budget, which it refers to as appropriations, the word is it appropriates a budget, is less than the entire cultural budget of the City of London. So this in itself should, you know, sort of reveals our attitude, our sort of the attitude of our politicians, our leaders towards the arts, right? And within that small budget, the NEA has to fund the literary arts, the performing arts, the visual arts, and it has to cater to not only all the states of the country, but also all the populations, disabled artists, you know, native artists, you know, everybody who's been left behind. So this is why, you know, you find statements like, you know, teach your child trumpet, it'll help them do better in math and science, because we have to somehow convince a corporation that this is worth investing in.
Yes. There's some justification sort of in economic
and a tangible good, right?
Yes.
A tangible good that somehow we will produce future better technology technologists because you invested in arts in their childhood.
Yes.
So you know, there's that one attitude there. You know, what is the attitude towards the arts, right? The other thing is an appreciation. And here comes, once again, our strategizing as arts administrators. And I want, you know, since we're talking to potential students and future workers in the culture sphere, I want to say this. Yes, of course, the artists and structures sustaining art will be your focus, but don't forget the audiences. Okay? Because who are you ultimately serving? And who are these artists ultimately serving? So one quick example I'm going to give you. When the Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico and it devastated the island, and artists lost their compositions, they lost their instruments, they lost their homes. Same thing happened with Hurricane Katrina. I was the assistant to a great, great New Orleans pianist, Henry Butler. He was visually impaired. He was blind, and I used to read his newspaper for him. That's how I cut my teeth in this work. He came to New York because he was displaced from New Orleans because of Katrina, right? When you think about it, I want you all to ask a question: whose children will be affected if the arts get taken away? Mm-hmm. Now, in America, you know, white children have access to ballet, symphonic orchestras, in a way that black and native kids have never been invited to these spaces. So you want to think about the inequity when you think about who is going to become the adult audience to sustain your industry.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to be able to afford to buy your tickets? The American subscription models in opera and theater are gone because your audiences are now a hybrid audience. They are not going to fully invest in Carnegie Hall, or they're not going to fully invest in Lincoln Center. They're going to go everywhere.
Demographics have changed, and the indicators of that behavior have changed.
Absolutely. So I want you all to think about audiences you serve. When you think about interventions, you know, the sort of big topic of identity politics that the world says has entered everything, and America has exported their identity politics to us. You know, I want you to think about who is becoming in charge of these spaces. So women who look like me, for example, were never part of arts the arts philanthropy world before. So one colleague of mine, and once again, her quote, she's a black American dancer. She now serves, you know, the black sort of dance network. Mm-hmm, and she's also a funder. And she said, Gargi, when you bring a black arts administrator in this work, our accountability is not to the white structures of the organization that has hired us. Our accountability is towards our community that has been left behind. And what a wake-up call. You know, Carson, when you and I were in Germany together, I remember one of our colleagues, when I did my presentation, who brought up this question of identity politics, and they said, my God, you ask for a self-identification data in all your forms, you know. In France, this would be considered racial profiling. Well, you know, at the time, I didn't have the presence of mind. But France has its own history of racial profiling. You know, trying to understand an artist's identity to say, who have we not supported, is not a racial profiling problem. It's how you treat black and Middle Eastern immigrants in your police relationship, in your incarceration structures. That's a racial profiling problem.
It reminds you of the internal debate in France, very briefly. Just by not asking the question, one is going along with the situation as it is, with the status quo, without wanting to delve deeper.
You are complicit. And you know, Carson, I wanted to share this with you, that even when Chamber Music America took this step to say, from here on, we're going to ask our artists to self-identify, right? It is a difficult conversation to have in an organization, you know, because then we had questions like, well, I'm multiracial. So I'm not black. I'm not even white. And then, you know, artists start to say, well, are you now just going to give, you know, grants to other artists who make up your missing puzzle? Yes. And that's really not the case. You know, as arts administrators, the burden of collecting this data lies between your interpretation to your funder to advocate for more funds. It is never a question about artistry. Although I don't need to say that black artists are some of the most venerated artists in jazz music. This is their music, you know.
Yes.
But we don't have to make a statement to prove their excellence in this music. It's there. But, you know, don't don't be afraid to take on the difficult questions. Mm-hmm. Because by being silent, as you just so well illustrated, Karsten, you are choosing not to engage with the problems. And in that way, you are choosing to remain complicit in the problems. Yeah. How will change come?
Exactly. Gorgi, that's a question, isn't it, of how will change come? Obviously, in the next 2-3 minutes we've got to round off our conversation, we're not going to give exhaustive answers to that, although you've already pointed the way with practical examples of how it's being done. But I really appreciated sort of thinking of also those members in our audience, our listeners, which you're focusing a lot on, the audience, also the prospective maybe managers, directors in arts organizations. Couple of minutes to somehow maybe even point out maybe the main changes and where they might be coming from already.
Sure. The main changes are coming in terms of how we understand and gather data. That's really where the change is coming. Mm. So I would advise everybody to understand, take a course in statistics. I never thought I would use it, but here it is. Yes. It's right here. The better you are able to interpret your data and communicate that data to your funding body, the better you will be able to advocate not only for the artists, but you will be able to develop support for them. Mm-hmm. Because we're now talking about society, right? We're not simply talking about this piece of art that is not connected to the body that created it and the body that will experience it. We are, when we talk about art, we talk about culture, we talk about society, you know? Mm-hmm. So obviously, if public policy is using data, arts has to use data. There's no question about it.
That's the language which we'll get through.
That's correct. And also, you will be remiss as students in this work and future if you don't study histories, study colonial history. Mm. You know, there's some great books. I always go back to Homi Bhabha, the great cultural theorist, but also Edward Said. Read up on that excellent book, Orientalism, which still holds true. Read up on Black historians. You know, Abraham Kendi is one who's now, you know, writing some very important work. Ta-Nehisi Coates. I want to point out that in the century-old history of the Metropolitan Museum, I beg your pardon, Metropolitan Opera in the United States, in New York City, in the century-old history, Karsten, they will be commissioning their first Black composer. You know, this is how long it's taken. That's, so you cannot do the work. So the trend, it's sort of anachronistic to say that history has become a trend. But history has become a trend. And you have to understand multiple histories. I cannot serve the jazz community well if I don't understand Black history in the United States. Yeah. So these are going to be the two corner points. Mm-hmm. One is you're going to be better while you're getting your fine arts degree or museum studies degree. You have to study history and history of oppression and colonialism, right? Because look, our world is coming close. Our world is coming together. So the colonial, the colonized societies are now becoming part of societies that were first, you know, part of the colonizing mission. So you're going to have to know that. And the second is study your statistics.
That's right.
Because you have to interpret that.
Yes.
To pause
and there. I think pausing there ourselves really sort of brings it home, because with the statistics, as you mentioned, there's the narrative, there's the storytelling, there's the creativity that comes out of it, but based on the facts and the good real picture of what's going on around us. And I think, Gorgi, thank you very much, because you've really provided that for us today in this brief space of time. So thank you once again very much, Gorgi, for sharing those experiences.
The pleasure is all mine, Karsten. Thank you. And it's so good to see you thriving despite this pandemic.
Thank you. Thank you again.
Il-kama li ħattu gost jisimaw dak il-klim u anke l-mużika ta' Gorgi Shindig, illi jistess ukoll f'għaltilna hija mhux biss riċerkatriċi u manager t-monkey imdaħla fil-dinja performativa sess, tal-art u l-kultura, u jekk il-każ li tirrob isimgħu forsi din il-programm hemm anke l-oħrajn ta' qablu tistgħu jsibu kollox fuq is-sit ta' Campus FM jew inkella inaħdu magħna dejjem fuq ir-radju direttament fuq is-sezon tar-radju biex tisimgħu anke l-bqija tas-sensiela minn Campus għal ieħor. Jiena Karsten Xwieraq, nirringrazzjak.